It's Friday, March the 26th, and you are very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Over the last few years, and in particular, I suppose, since the US presidential election of 2016 and the Brexit referendum of that same year, we've heard more and more about how political debate and argument is being driven less by traditional ideological and policy differences and more by what are generally called culture wars. These so-called wars over issues such as racial and gender identity are in turn often framed as a battle over what limits, if any, should be placed on speech, whether that speech takes place on college campuses, on the pages of newspapers, on social media services like Facebook and Twitter, or indeed anywhere else. It's a pretty complex and sometimes exhausting, and to my mind anyway, often pretty unproductive debate, which frequently degenerates rapidly into ad hominem abuse and insults about wokedom and cancel culture and the like. However, it is impossible to ignore the traction which these issues have gained in public discourse and the way in which they impact on broader society. So is the central accusation true that free speech, which is arguably the most important right in any functioning democracy, is currently under real threat? That is the belief of my guest today, Andrew Doyle, whose new book is called Free Speech and Why It Matters. Andrew, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe we should start with what, it's a phrase I hate, but maybe we should start with your journey, because it's an interesting one of how you landed up writing this particular book. You've had, you've been a comedian, a satirist, you have a certain kind of presence on Twitter, you've been a teacher, you've been lots of different things. So maybe it might help just to put that in context first.
Okay. Well, when I started out in my adult life, I was all set to be an academic, and I was a part-time lecturer while I was researching for my doctorate. And then I got put off doing that by one of my supervisors, who basically warned me that I would end up insane, running around the quad screaming, "Why have I wasted my life?" Those were his exact words. So I did get put off from doing that. But also I was writing plays and writing comedy and sketch shows and that kind of thing in tandem with all of that. And I was often getting the bus down, because I was in Oxford at the time, so I was getting the bus down to London to rehearse and put on plays at fringe venues and that kind of thing. And then I ended up getting out of academia and living in London because there was an elderly woman who used to come and see a lot of my shows, and she basically said, "Come and live with me for free and you can write." So it was like having the equivalent of a patron. So I was very lucky in that respect because I didn't have any money and I wouldn't have been able to do it otherwise. And then I ran out of money completely and decided the only thing I could do is teach. So I became a teacher, and I was a teacher for a number of years. All the while I was doing stand-up. And then I started earning enough from the stand-up circuit to go part-time. And then I started earning enough to go full-time as a comic. So I ended up as a full-time stand-up comedian. And I wasn't teaching after that. And then I started writing political articles and articles about culture for Spiked magazine. And then various other things came out of that. So I started writing for other publications after that. And so I've had the sort of two dual careers. I've had the sort of writer, satirist, comedian career on one hand, and then the sort of cultural and political commentary on the other. Although I do think the two sort of inform each other and help each other. And that's where I've got to, basically.
And as part of that, we should mention as well that you you created a very successful, I think she has 600,000 followers now, a fictional Twitter character.
Yes, but that's Titania McGrath, who is a character who I just invented to, I suppose, to satirise the kind of conduct you see on Twitter from a certain, a particularly zealous type of social justice activist who, you know, want to be offended by absolutely everything, and have found a kind of way to legitimize bullying others. You know, they're positioning themselves on the side of the angels as a means to justify vicious and bullying behavior. And I thought there was an interesting contradiction there. Some of the more zealous social justice activists are everything that they claim not to be. They are everything they claim to be fighting against. You know, they're not really for social justice or equality or liberalism. They're against all of those things. And they're certainly against free speech. And so I thought it was quite an interesting satirical idea to embody that kind of character. So that's what happened there. And then that led to, she's written a couple of books and she's been on, she's had a live show and that kind of thing. So so that was going on as well at the sort of same time. So yeah.
So I suppose the theme of the book is an increasing threat to free speech, I suppose. And one of the things that's notable, and I think, don't think anybody could argue with, is that many of the arguments in favour of free speech and against censorship used to be framed with the left being in favour of free speech and conservatives and people on the right being in favour of certain constraints of speech. I mean, I'm speaking to you from Ireland, obviously, and it has had a long and ignoble tradition of censorship of lots of different kinds of speech, including some of its own greatest writers. And that would have been my experience as a young man, was to kind of see that in action and other forms of censorship. But now it seems to have switched around, and the criticism of constraints on free speech seem largely to be coming from the political right, and the defence of constraints on speech seem to be happening to the left. And that seems to be going on for a long time. So one of the first things I want to ask you is this a debate that goes back to the political correctness to-ing and fro-ing of the late 80s and the early 90s?
It's connected, I think, but it's not the same thing. I think one of the most common errors that people make is to assume that the political correctness movement is the same thing as what we call the woke movement or the social justice movement. They're very, very different, in fact. And the current sort of identitarian, what you'd call an intersectional movement, no one really knows what to call it, actually, which makes it quite a difficult thing to grapple with, is at its heart authoritarian. And the political correctness movement wasn't about that. That was about trying to sort of develop the ever-evolving social contract so that we have a broadly agreed way in which we address each other in the workplace, in public spaces, in schools, in that kind of thing. And that's just called politeness, really. I would say there were certainly elements of the political correctness movement that were overzealous and went too far, and people were, you know, fired when they shouldn't have been fired, and things like that happened occasionally, but not very often, actually. And I think, broadly speaking, it was necessary, and it did help society. I remember when I was a very young child, there were quite unpleasant and commonly heard sort of certainly homophobic slurs, occasional even racist slurs on TV, for instance, things like this. And I don't think that's helpful for a society. And I think we reached a point where we all understood that this is not the way that we should behave. So to me, the political correctness movement was a good thing. And I would say that the current movement is not that. It's a kind of perversity of that notion, I suppose, is what I mean.
I suppose people might push back against that, though, and say that perhaps there's an English rock music writer, I can't remember who he is, but he essentially suggests that you know, whatever albums were released at the time you were aged 18 are always going to be, in your view, the greatest albums of all time. And equally, yeah, we all have a moment in our life, perhaps when we think things were just about right, just the way that they should be. And there's a continual tension between conservatism and whatever you may want to call the other side, liberalism, progressivism, whatever, where conservatives are thinking things have just gone a bit too far. And I just wonder, you know, I mean, are you suggesting that sometime between, I don't know, the Oasis Blur Wars and the millennium, that political correctness went too far and it had a sweet spot beforehand?
No, because I don't think it is political correctness. That's my whole point. I mean, I'm not one of these people that looks back fondly on the artists and culture of my youth and says that was the golden era. In fact, if ever I want to read a book or watch a film and I want it to be good, I'll make sure that it was produced before I was born. So I'm not one of those people that has that kind of nostalgic feeling about that. I would say you always have to be on the guard against falling into the trap of thinking that just because things are changing, society is changing, that's a bad thing because you're not accustomed to it. But that's also a misunderstanding of conservatism. Conservatives aren't, although the word does mean, you know, obviously wanting things to remain, to conserve, to keep things the same. But actually, the philosophy of conservatism doesn't mean that. It isn't resistant to things changing. It's more about adapting to change. And I think the left-right thing is a bit of a misnomer. I think, as you've already pointed out, you know, I think when we were both young, we would have associated calls for censorship with the right. You certainly did see that. I remember one of my very explicit memories is of the tabloids, the right-wing tabloids, trying to ban David Cronenberg's film Crash. And that is the kind of thing that we now see from leftist publications or self-identified leftist publications like The Guardian, which I don't consider left-wing really, but it does consider itself to be. So I think that's the change, and that's an interesting shift. However, it isn't really a partisan issue. I mean, even today, you will hear people on the right calling for censorship. You will. I mean, when Jo Brand made her joke about Nigel Farage, people were calling for her to be arrested. And that was coming from right-wing voices. So this isn't about left and right, really. It just happens that at the moment, most of the voices calling for censorship are predominantly those who claim to be left-wing. So that is true.
I've got to push back slightly on that. I've got a quote in front of me here. It says this: the movement arises from the laudable desire to sweep away the debris of racism and sexism and hatred. It replaces old prejudice with new ones. It declares certain topics off limits, certain expressions off limits, even certain gestures off limits. That's former President George H.W. Bush in 1991, which is really when that whole political correctness debate was really kicking off. And that's a clear political articulation, which sounds pretty much identical to what's being said today.
Yes, but he's talking about a different movement and he's doing it from a different perspective. Just because someone's critique of the political correctness movement has echoes of some current critiques of the social justice movement does not mean that the movements are identical. That would be a flawed way of looking at that. I think often you hear a rhetoric reverberating in different contexts. It happens absolutely all the time in politics. The mistake, the trap there is to assume that they're talking about the same thing and they're not.
I should say that I have a lot of sympathy for much of the many of the arguments which are made in the book. And maybe we turn first of all to where I think you've already suggested this, the whole thing started, the whole thing being this movement. And you write about the French intellectuals of the 1960s and the 1970s, Foucault, Derrida, who looked to understand the world really in a different way through the prism of language, that the world was a human construct constructed through language, and that truth, I suppose, was malleable or could be reconstructed as a result of that. And then later, more in English-speaking universities, that concept was developed to apply to a set of progressive political notions, which could be progressed, or so the theory went, through changing language and the way we use language. And therefore, what we've ended up with is this war over language. Is that a fair kind of representation of what you're saying?
I think that's right. I think I would argue that is the origin of this. I can't say for sure, but I'm convinced of those arguments. I mean, I've read about the way in which postmodernism and certainly the French post-structuralists you've just mentioned there sort of sowed the seeds of these ideas. And then what happened around 1989 is you get a sudden surge of activism within higher education from teaching staff. And they call this applied postmodernism because, of course, Foucault and Lyotard and the rest of them were not attempting to apply their ideas to society in that kind of way. They were theorizing, whereas the applied postmodernists of the late 80s and early 90s were very much trying to change society. And this is why we now find ourselves in a situation where higher education is dominated by activists, or at least academics who are activists first and scholars second. And that's where a lot of the problems do come. And of course, this does end up seeping out into culture. And what you end up with is a discourse and a very sort of a mainstream discourse, I would say, that has its roots in postmodernism, but is actually not postmodernism, is actually a kind of a misunderstanding of postmodernism. In fact, the postmodernists were very much pushing back against grand narratives, and part of that would be whatever that might be in terms of science, in terms of religion, politics, whatever. The grand narratives of history was something which was fundamentally what they were trying to deconstruct. And it's interesting to me that those who claim their lineage from the likes of Foucault will now push their own grand narrative, which is that they are on the right side of history. This is their grand narrative that they have embraced. And actually, were Foucault alive today, he would have a lot of fun, I think, deconstructing the woke movement and pointing how it's completely opposed to what he believes. So there's an interesting tension there.
Can I suggest another way of framing that process? And maybe this is the old economic determinist within me, which is that the academy is not a fixed thing. The academy, universities as they existed in the 1960s when those French writers were at work is extremely different from what it is now. Apart from anything else, universities and third level institutions have exploded in size, and a far, far higher proportion of the population now has third level degrees. So their position within the society itself is very different, and that feeds into questions of who are elites and what is defined as elites now. We see that, for example, in the way that increasingly, both in terms of the Brexit vote and American elections, voters are defined by whether or not they have a third level education or not. So what I'm saying is that third level education is now an entirely different kind of a thing, and that has to be one of the contributing factors into the kinds of changes that you're talking about. It's not just a bunch of academics sitting around in tweed jackets, although they probably don't have tweed jackets anymore, having these arguments with themselves.
No, that's right. More people are going to university, to put it simply. You know, back in the 60s, very few people did. I mean, it was a very interesting, when it came to the Brexit debate, I mean, the statistics around this, it was very interesting the way that this was spun. You know, people were trying to say, well, more educated people tended to vote Remain and less educated tended to vote Leave, of course, forgetting that most of the people in the older bracket simply didn't have the opportunity to go to university. It was a strange thing that was missed. But yeah, I think that's right. I think more and more people are educated within a system that promotes activism. And, you know, it is the case now we have reached the point where, I mean, I know because I was a teacher and I've spoken to pupils who have gone into that system recently and emerged from it in a kind of indoctrinated form and are actually less capable of critical thinking than when they went in. So that is a problem. I think you're right. And I think that is because of the nature of the academe has changed and the nature of higher education has changed. And it is now the case, certainly in the humanities and the social sciences, that in order to succeed in those degrees, you not only have to be good at what you do, you have to be in agreement with the academic activists who are marking your work. I've had explicit experience of this where one boy produced a fantastic piece of research. I know because I was, I read it. I was involved in, he interviewed me as part of it. And the academics in question wanted to fail the piece because the argument he was promoting was against their ideology. But, you know, it was far more sophisticated than most of the things that they had produced. So I think it's very interesting that we are in that situation now. Certainly things are worse in America. I think it's possible that the humanities in America are kind of over. But, you know, I like to be optimistic about these things and we shouldn't give up on higher education. But there is just a disproportionate contingent of this ideological capture within higher education. And as I say, we've seen what happens when that seeps into society in a half-understood, filtered form. It can be quite dangerous for basic principles of a liberal democracy, including free speech, including equality, including freedom of the press and all the rest of it.
I wonder, is it not, though, maybe partly, I mean, just setting aside the core issues here, it's about a contestation of elites. There's a theory going around that that there's an overproduction of elites and that therefore, you know, the kind of credentialism you see where you now need to have a primary degree or maybe even a PhD to do a job that you didn't need any of those things for 20 years ago has led to a kind of an arms war in society. And that the kind of thing you're talking about, because a lot of the time your book comes back to people being denied jobs or losing their jobs, is about that. It's about too many people scrabbling around for too few resources.
Well, that's possibly true. I mean, I'm not making speculations about that particularly. When I'm talking about people losing their jobs, it isn't the case that the incidents that I cite, and indeed there's quite a number that I specifically mention in the footnotes, these aren't people who are suffering from the consequences of an overburdened system and too much competition within their industry. These are examples of people who have lost their jobs for having opinions that are unfashionable or for misspeaking. Or for something they posted on Facebook 10 years ago, which has now been dug up and misrepresented. It's a very different thing. It's a different discussion. I'm talking specifically about a new kind of intolerance that does not recognise the possibility that people can make mistakes, move on and change their mind, that doesn't believe in redemption, and that essentially at its core has vengeance, that is driven by vengeance. And you see this all the time. A very good example would have been what was the name of the editor of the Waitrose food magazine, William Sitwell. I only mentioned this because it was a publicised event. Of course, most examples of cancel culture aren't publicised because they happen disproportionately to ordinary working people. But let's take this example. He received an email from a freelance journalist asking to write a piece on veganism. He replied with a flippant, silly joke about whatever it was. It was to do with cannibalism. It was, shall we force feed vegans to, I don't know what the joke was, but it was silly. I read it and I thought it was quite funny and just stupid. It was difficult to take in an offensive way. Speaking as a vegetarian, I didn't find it remotely offensive. I thought it was silly. And rather than speak to him about it, rather than the freelance journalist saying, I find that offensive, can we have a conversation about this and resolve our difficulty here? She screenshot the email, put it online, and within a day he was forced to resign. That's the difference. It's a kind of difference in mentality. Which is now just absolutely commonplace. It is getting worse. It does worry me. I spoke to a friend of mine who's a head of a school. Now, I spoke at this school a number of years ago, probably about 4 or 5 years ago. And there was a pushback there. There was a kind of prickliness, a kind of bigotry amongst the pupils where they were just not happy about hearing different viewpoints. But it wasn't that bad because I could push back on it, and they were open enough to discuss. And she's now told me that it's a lot worse now. There's a real blazing intolerance that is becoming more and more prevalent among the young. This complete certainty, this very chilling certainty that you get whenever in history ideology replaces truth and thought. It's just a standard feature because you're outsourcing your thinking capacity to a set of rules. And the intolerance is becoming quite frightening. And a number of the teachers that I'm still in contact with, obviously from my days as a teacher, will say the same thing. There's a kind of intransigence now, an unwillingness to even discuss issues in an open way. And there's all sorts of reasons for that. And I don't claim to know all the answers for why that has happened. But what I will say is I think it is something that should concern anyone who cares about critical thinking and who cares about the values of a liberal democracy and free speech, indeed.
Do we have any data on this? The reason I ask that is because these stories, like the story of the Waitrose stories, which you just said, it's horrifying, I think, you know, it's abysmal. And, you know, I see stories closer to home, or closer to home, at least in that they're in my profession of journalism in American newspapers, which are equally bad. But then sometimes I kind of take a step back and I say, yes, that New York Times journalist was treated appallingly and I'm really cross about it. And then I kind of go, well, 15 years ago, I didn't even have a New York Times subscription. The idea would have been absurd, and I would have had no idea who that journalist was. And I'd never have heard about this. And perhaps this event would have happened, or perhaps not. But in fact, probably what drove it was a bunch of technologies that finds me knowing about it again. And basically, I get into this argument loop with myself, and I'm not sure how productive that is. But I suppose what I'm wondering is, you see these stories, and you see them nightly on American TV news, where some, you know, not very bright associate professor in some no-name university somewhere issues some stupid edict, and then it ends up on Twitter, and the next thing you know, it's the top item on Tucker Carlson's Fox News show. Now, the thing itself may be terrible, but the scale at which it is now being amplified and broadcast may not represent the realistic scale of the problem.
If you want to know the realistic scale of the problem, there's all sorts of resources you can look at. A very, very good book by Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff is The Coddling of the American Mind. And they cite all sorts of studies. Just to give you an example, there was a poll for the Pew Research Center 2015, which found that 40% of people between the ages of 18 and 34 were now in favor on the government prohibiting speech that is considered offensive. That would be an example. In our country, actually, there have been a number of studies about attitudes within universities and people self-censoring. This is something that is happening now an awful lot. There was a recent study in the US by the Heterodox Academy, which found that more than half of the academics, more than half of the respondents who took part in that, and this is a big field, believed that they couldn't express certain views in an academic setting without damaging their career trajectory. We've had similar studies in the UK which have found that a significant proportion of academics are now self-censoring because they believe that if they don't, their career will be either destroyed or at least their promotion prospects will be destroyed. We have the similar situation on university campuses. The data is in on this. Significant proportions of students are uncomfortable about expressing mainstream legitimate opinions because they fear for what will happen if they do so. We're not talking about people who want to go on homophobic rants or talk about how women should be in the kitchen or anything reactionary or like this. We're talking about people who have very normal mainstream views that just don't happen to be the establishment view. And by the establishment view, I'm not talking about the political establishment in terms of left and right. I'm talking about the social justice establishment, which is very much now predominant in all of our major cultural, education and political institutions. So that is a problem. The thing about this is we can take these isolated incidents and these can be spun by right-wing commentators in order to promote a narrative of victimhood, which you do often find from people on the right. Is what they will say is they'll take a prominent example of this and say, look, conservatives are being censored. Conservatives aren't able to say what they want anymore. Well, you know, that's not true. That's just an example of people pushing an agenda. But the data is in, you know, and it's a worrying picture that it paints. And the problem is that a lot of people will just ignore that. There's a lot of denialism. I know when Gavin Williamson in the UK made his statement about free speech on universities, and the response was weird because you would hear in articles in the New Statesman and the Guardian, those kind of publications, they just deny, outright flat deny what the data so clearly reveals, and that's not really helpful. You know, we should just address that there is a problem, accept that there is a problem. We know that, it's confirmed. And now we have to talk about what to do about it and not get distracted by the culture warriors of the left and the right who will try and turn this into another scrap in their battle.
Isn't that part of the problem, really? Because the question of what are we going to do about it is inevitably coloured by the fact that, as I said at the outset here, this has become a sort of a central plank of ongoing political discourse in the most mainstream way. And so there's one of the things that I really like about your book and about your podcast as well, is that you operate on the basis of that the people who you're talking about are themselves operating in good faith until proved otherwise. And I think that's a really kind of core principle of free speech, actually, to let free speech work. But clearly there's a lot of bad faith on all sides here. And there's things like, I mean, you know, the dead cat strategy, which I think the Australian strategy, political strategist Linton Crosby devised, which is that if something embarrassing is going on in a room, take out a dead cat and fling it on the table and everybody goes, oh God, look at the dead cat, and they forget what it was they were talking about. And it does seem to me that some of these issues are used as a dead cat strategy, particularly by conservatives, and particularly in the United States. For example, Donald Trump behaved more appallingly than any American president in the country's 250-year history in a whirlwind of activity that ended up with a violent riot and an occupation of the country's legislature in the middle of an important vote. And like two or three weeks later, he showed up at the prime annual conservative conference and the tag across the top of the conference was uncancelled, we're not going to be cancelled. That's a dead cat. And there's a lot of dead catting goes on about this subject.
There is. And I think the example you give is exactly right. That's an example of the kind of thing that I would push back against and that I would resist. I would disagree with you, however, insofar as I think it is happening more commonly now on the social justice left. I specifically say social justice left because I don't think they are left, because they're not concerned about economic inequality or class inequality. They're concerned about identity politics. But those are the people who are predominantly the ones who have... And the reason actually for this is they are not interested in truth at heart. They don't believe in truth. This is why you hear phrases such as your truth, such as lived experience, because they don't believe in the notion of truth, and they don't think it's helpful, which is why they disregard data that disproves their point of view. Or they will claim that the data has been constructed within a cis-hetero patriarchal framework and therefore has no validity. So when you're dealing with that kind of person, I mean, and I'll give you another example. So there's a fantastic movement in the UK called Counterweight, which is set up to promote social liberalism and to push back against the illiberalism of critical social justice within the workplace, the kind of thing that where the equivalent of a Robin DiAngelo will come into a corporation to berate the staff about how racist they all are and about how anyone who is white is complicit in white supremacy and this kind of divisive, dangerous stuff. And there's a lot of money being made out of it. And of course, Counterweight is this group that is run by Helen Pluckrose, is pushing back and saying actually social liberalism has a proven track record of addressing racial inequality and working to rectify those problems within society. Now, today, in fact, on Twitter, an academic literally smeared Counterweight and said that these are just people who are trying to dehumanize those who are interested in racial equality. In fact, to join Counterweight, you have to pledge your support for racial equality above all else. Now, in that situation, what has happened is the academic is simply ignoring what the group is saying their aims are and pretending that their aims are this sort of nefarious underhand thing which is not stated. In other words, he is not entering to a discussion in a civil way or assuming good faith, and therefore no progress can be made. Now, if he cared about his own movement and if he was serious about racial equality, he would take them at their word and then talk about which is the best solution to racial equality. Is it critical race theory, which would say that all social situations have racism at their core, even our discussion now? They could say has racism at its core, and they would say how is racism manifesting in this situation, not has racism occurred in this situation. Is it critical race theory, which would try to segregate and has indeed literally segregated parents and students in American schools? There was a recent case in California at the Brentwood School where parents were asked to segregate according to their skin colour for a parents' evening discussion with teachers, things like that. So the logical endpoint, of course, of this kind of identity politics is segregation. Now, is that really the best way to resolve issues of racial inequality in society? Or is it in fact making our society more racist? I think it is making our society more racist, and I think quite demonstrably so. And I would say that the progress that has been made since the civil rights of the 1960s, since those movements, shows just what can be achieved through social liberalism and an emphasis on equality, and yes, an emphasis on the ideal of colorblindness, which does not mean that you don't see different races, but that you don't treat people differently on that basis. And I think that is a beautiful ideal that we need to reclaim. And it's not helpful to have a hyper-racialized society brought into being by theorists who ultimately will make our society more divided and make what they claim to want to achieve less likely.
I suppose I'm slightly uncomfortable about getting into a deep debate. I'm both not qualified, and I'm also uncomfortable about two white blokes having a debate about critical race theory. And when you've discussed it on your podcast, you've discussed it with people who come from broader perspectives in terms of their own personal histories.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not uncomfortable because I think ideas transcend things like skin colour. And I think it's actually very important to be able to do this. It's very interesting as well that critical race theorists don't appear to be uncomfortable with this when Robin DiAngelo does it. And when she writes, I mean, this is a white woman who is probably the foremost and most recognisable voice of critical race theory. I think it's a misnomer. The overemphasis on identity, your race, gender and sexuality somehow gives you special privilege to be able to talk about certain issues. I think that's actually a very dangerous point of view. I think
I'm not saying I refuse to talk about it or anything like that. I prefer, as the host of this podcast,
okay,
to include include a wider range of voices. Maybe we can come back and do it at some point.
And that's my personal preference.
I'm not scared of anybody. I'm not self-censoring. I'm making an editorial decision. People often confuse editorial decisions.
No, I'm not criticizing you for that. I was actually making a broader point about this problem. I actually do make an effort to include those. I'm interested, yes, above all, to speak to the very people who advance these ideas. The trouble is they never want to, because they say that this isn't up for debate. I'm above all keen to, I mean, look, most of my reading, most of the stuff I read is their side of the argument.
I suppose when people hear you say that about critical race theory, however well read or not they may not be in critical race theory itself, they hear somebody criticizing implicitly movements which they're aware of, like Black Lives Matter or whatever it might be. And very often, and this is part of the bad faith arguments that go around, that's then misrepresented as being against moves towards towards greater racial equality. And quite clearly, there are significant moves that still need to be made in that direction, particularly in the United States. And maybe one of the problems is that we get trapped into these American arguments a lot of the time. And they translate very badly. For example, the thorny, you know, centuries-long history of American racial politics rooted in slavery, with the kind of the intimacy and the adjacency and, you know, the direct violence that comes with, is quite different from a separate set of questions which we have to address here in Ireland or in the UK.
It's hugely different. It's incompatible, actually. I mean, you can't just take critical race theory, which is so rooted in America and American history and the legacy of slavery and that kind of thing. You can't take even intersectionality, the views of Kimberly Crenshaw and, you know, and Derek Bell. You can't take these ideas and just transplant them wholesale onto a completely different cultural context. But that is, in fact, what is happening. This is why I'm very nervous about it, because it's simply incoherent. It doesn't work. And this is why when critical race theory starts seeping into schools, as it is doing over here, and when we have people claiming that our schools and universities, the higher education in the UK is systemically racist, when all of the data tells us that is absolutely not the case. Well, you know, it is just an incoherent stance to take. So I would say, absolutely, part of my resistance against critical race theory is that it simply doesn't apply over here. But actually, I would also say that in America, it's important to push back against it. I think the new group out there, FAIR, which is the Foundation Against Intolerance and Racism, which is pushing back against critical race theory, because it and the work of Christopher Ruffo, who I've spoken to on my podcast, because it recognises that even in the American context, critical race theory is disastrous and actually is likely to accentuate racial problems. But yes, you're right. I think we shouldn't be bringing in theories that simply don't apply to this country or our history.
And also, is there something, it seems to me, culturally American about the way some of these things play out? America's always had this dichotomy between, you know, Puritans burning witches in the 17th century and, you know, Enlightenment gentlemen devising a constitutional democracy in the 18th. And I think that that's always played down to America is a weird place because, you know, it holds up individuality as almost a religion in a way that most countries don't. But it's also incredibly conformist in many ways.
Yeah, I think that's right. No, I disagree with you. I don't think I don't have anything more to add, really.
Well, then let me go on to the actual question of free speech. Because to be honest, I probably thought a few years ago that I was pretty close to a free speech fundamentalist. And I'm not so sure about that now. And it's not because my views have changed, but because some of these issues have, you know, forced me to think a bit more of them. And, you know, people talk about, you know, the marketplace of ideas. And the marketplace of ideas... Any marketplace, by definition, is regulated to some extent. And if you look at something like the last great information technology revolution, Gutenberg's invention of the printing press, that was followed in the centuries that succeeded it by, you know, the introduction of defamation law, of copyright law, of all kinds of constraints, many of them terrible, some of which we've got rid of, some of which we've finessed. I've got all kinds of constraints in what I do in my job as an editor, as a writer, both in terms of internal guidelines and outside laws, including a press ombudsman and a press council, which we have here in Ireland. Free speech has never fully existed, has it? I mean, the most powerful method of communication still right now is broadcasting, which has always been highly regulated.
I think free speech is a very rare and actually relatively recent development in human history. I think we are very lucky to live in a society that has it. And I think, you know, this is why I'm concerned, and I think it's very easy to get complacent about it, you know, but it will slip away. I think the kind of constraints you're describing are not really often free speech issues. So, for instance, I mean, defamation, libel, you know, there are other ways in which you can use speech to commit crimes, espionage, perjury, blackmail. You know, I'm not someone who says, oh, you should have the right to blackmail, use your speech to blackmail someone else because I'm against criminal activity. It's not a free speech issue, and those things sort of get conflated.
Should I ask you, should I be allowed stand outside a Jewish family's house with a swastika flag reading out the protocols of the Elders of Zion?
It's already illegal to commit acts of harassment, and I would suggest that that probably veers into the harassment territory. I would say that if you were protesting peacefully, then I'm happy to support that. I don't support what you're protesting in that case. I think it's abhorrent. But
if,
I think the alternative is worse.
If I did the same thing at somebody online on a regular basis all the time, in other words, I was
exactly
in their feed all the time.
Well, that would be for a start, that would be definitely harassment if you were continually targeting an individual. That is already against the law, of course. So a lot of the concerns that you're raising about free speech, I think people should just console themselves. These things are already illegal. It's not legal to harass someone in that way. If someone wants to stand outside my house with a big picket that says gay people should burn in hell, then I think they're wasting their time and I'm going to ignore them. I might attempt to argue with them, but if they're too insane on this issue, I will probably just ridicule them or whatever. But I don't want them arrested. And the reason I don't want them arrested is because I don't want to dilute a principle that is much bigger than them. In other words, I don't want to give them the power that they don't deserve to have me renege on my fundamental principles. So that's where I think if they were following me around the street and continually targeting me in that way, then that would become harassment, wouldn't it? Which is already illegal, and so we don't have to worry about it.
I suppose, but that's of course absolutely fair enough. I think what it illustrates is the problem. I mean, I mentioned culture wars. Your podcast is called Culture Wars, and a lot of this stuff, partly because of the new digital technology which it's conducted on, reduces incredibly quickly to a binary, a black and a white, a for or against, or all those kind of things. Whereas what I was saying about I'm not a fundamentalist anymore is that I see that these things work on a spectrum, and I would see myself as being a strong defender of free speech. But I, you know, culture changes over time, social norms change over time. To some extent, laws change over time. Within all those, I would see myself as wanting to allow as much free speech as possible. But I'm aware that there are subtle adjustments there. It's not an either or, a black or a white.
Which is exactly why we need to be able to restore civil conversations between people who disagree, and particularly when it comes to free speech. You'll know from having read my book that I'm not dismissing people's concerns about free speech. I'm addressing them in good faith. And that is because I don't think it's helpful to simply take an absolutist stance and say, I'm not going to listen to what you've got to say on this issue. That's actually what I think is at the very core of most of the problems we face at the moment, is people aren't talking to each other, you know? And I think that the culture wars is a brilliant example of it. I think the culture wars, we need to end these. This needs to stop, you know? The reason my podcast is called Culture Wars is because I'm a critic of the culture wars, not a participant. And I think it's very important that those two things are not conflated and that we are able to restore civil dialogue and disagreement. You know, I want to have the conversations about free speech, the very things that you're describing. I understand that it is complex and that when someone is some hate-fueled demagogue is calling for some awful things, I understand why people are concerned about that. I understand why people are concerned about the notion of hate speech, even though I reject the premise. I think, but we'll get absolutely nowhere if we don't take each other's viewpoints seriously and discuss them in good faith. We'll get nowhere at all. So that's really, I suppose, what I'm attempting to urge in the writing of the book, is not to polarize, is to bridge those gaps and to treat each other like adults and behave like adults.
Does the internet make that impossible, though?
Yeah, probably. I think it doesn't make it impossible insofar as we've always got the freedom to get off it. I think you can't have these discussions on Twitter, for instance. I've learned that to my peril, that it's pretty impossible. I mean, well, to be fair, every now and then, one in every 100, you know, times when someone comes at me with an argument, you know, for a start, the vast majority of people don't know what I think. They're just misrepresenting what I think. And I spend most of my time correcting them on what they perceive my viewpoint to be, which isn't useful anyway. But once you get past that hurdle, once they understand what you're trying to say, but they still disagree, then you can have a productive dialogue, but it rarely happens on Twitter. And the reason, I think, is probably it's too performative. I think there's always one eye on the invisible spectators that are inevitably there, and therefore ego intrudes. And whenever I find ego intruding in a debate, and that includes my own, I will withdraw from it because I don't think that's helpful. I think it means you're no longer interested in getting nearer to the truth. It means you're only interested in your own status.
I mean, these companies built these emotionally driven machines in order to sell advertising. I don't think they gave a damn about the political implications. It probably didn't even occur to them at all, actually. And it's dubious about how much they care about them now as well. But the way that those machines are built is just totally inimical to the sort of, you know, civilized discussion that you're talking about there.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. I think the best thing everyone could do is get off Twitter. I'm a hypocrite because I'm on it. But I do think it's ultimately very... I will get off it eventually. I think it's got to the point where, you know, there can be no possibility of any serious discussion on social media.
But you or I getting off it is not going to change the world.
No, it's not.
Fantastic though we are. And there is a question, as I come back to my point about the marketplace of ideas, you know, previous technologies, you know, people have figured out some parameters as to what they can or can't do. Like my life is a better place because Donald Trump isn't on Twitter, but I'm also deeply concerned that Twitter can just ban Donald Trump or indeed anybody else at the same time. So I'm conflicted about that, as I am among many other things. The difficulty is that there really are no rules because of the way the whole thing's been set up, largely because of American laws. You can blame the Americans again for this, of course.
I mean, it's always fun to do. I mean, that's a very good example, isn't it, of where your own principle becomes conflicting with, you know, what something that you just instinctively approve of. I mean, take Donald Trump, you know, I mean, I'm absolutely no fan of Donald Trump. And I suppose it would be very easy for me to rejoice in him not having that platform anymore. But then that would be for me to completely surrender my principle when it comes to free speech. And also, I do think it is in the public interest to hear what he has to say, being, you know, as he was leader of the free world. So I think that's quite important. And it does disturb me that, you know, there is a bigger principle at stake here, which is that we are living in this digital age, which we haven't, you know, this is all so new, and we are dealing with effectively a oligopoly of Silicon Valley tech giants who have more collective power than a nation state, but none of the democratic accountability. And they are able to wield such incredible power that they can actually deplatform an elected leader of a country. So it is a frightening prospect. And we do have to address this argument about them being private companies so they can do what they want. You know, I suppose technically if private companies could say, well, we won't have gay people on our platform, but I don't imagine that for a second that people would be happy with that. I think we do have to address the reality of living in an age when the chief and most obvious de facto public square of the globe is social media and is dominated by just a handful of probably ideologically driven billionaires who have absolutely no accountability to the public. That is a problem, and it's something we do have to address, and just ignoring it and wishing it away isn't going to help.
But the people who complain about it the most at the moment, because they're losing at the moment, and you're absolutely right, it's the people who are on the receiving end of this stuff. That's why they're complaining about it, and that's why you're getting it at CPAC and everything like that. They're the people who are largely responsible for setting up in the first place, because if those companies are anything, they are a hugely successful outgrowth of American capitalism and the free market.
Yeah, and that just goes to show why you need to... This is why you need to stand up for free speech, particularly when it's your enemies who are being threatened, who are being censored. That's why it's particularly important, because it's all very well at the moment. Yes, you're right. Conservatives tend to be more heavily censored on social media platforms. And the Biden administration has no appetite whatsoever to do anything about the problem of big tech censorship, because at the moment they are ideologically in line with the Jack Dorseys of the world. But the problem is, that's a very myopic point of view, because where will we be in 10 years' time, in 20 years' time? You've mentioned the conservatives who emphasize the free market, and where did that lead us? Well, nobody knows what's going to happen in the future. So I think there are principles that transcend notions of left and right, and that you should hold fast to those principles. And it's hard, because you end up having to defend the speech rights of people you despise. There's no point in defending uncontroversial speech, because it's never at risk. So it's something that I think, you know, the principle is bigger than the people.
But is there not a qualitative, or I'm not sure if it's a qualitative or a quantitative difference, between the reality that on one level, speech is freer than it ever was before because of these platforms. And that means, for example, that I see all kinds of shite coming at me on Twitter, which I would never have had in my relatively civilized, normal life 15 or 20 years ago. And people are able to say these things, whereas in a way, they could always have scribbled them on Biro notes and stuck them through my letterbox, I suppose. But, you know, they didn't, because that wasn't the practicality of it. And that we haven't managed yet to do what previous generations finally did, usually after a lot of messing around, which is to figure out how we apply the principles of a free and fair and open democracy to this new communications technology. It's not just a question of stopping Jack Dorsey banning Donald Trump. It's something that goes a lot deeper than that.
Yeah, and I don't know the answers. I think there is of course, the block function, which is built into the social media system. So in a sense, there is no reason for them to employ so many thousands of people to monitor speech on the platform. Because if there is speech you don't want to hear, you can simply block the person who is making that speech. Because part of the core aspect of freedom of speech, of course, is the right not to listen. People don't get to demand your attention. So there is, in fact, the block function on Twitter is the guarantee of free speech on the platform. So it's already there, really. And I think we just now have to address, what do we do about the problem? If it was simply the case that Twitter were deleting accounts that break the law, for instance, or post libelous threads or things like that, then that would be one thing. But that's not the situation we're facing. They routinely ban accounts that have the opinions they don't like.
But the reason they do that is, to go back to the American legislation in the 1990s, was because a bunch of politicians, including many of the conservative ones, some of whom are still around and are now complaining about this, reckoned they needed to do that to make these viable businesses, because they were afraid, for example, of things like these new services being flooded with pornography and spam. And in order for the companies to be able to set up what they called kind of walled sites, walled gardens, to protect against that kind of thing, they gave them the right, or they guaranteed them that right, to make decisions about what couldn't and wouldn't be on their platform.
And they weren't wrong to do so. It's actually quite essential, particularly with the proliferation of comment sections on news outlets. It is completely unfeasible to suggest that any particular outlet should be responsible for everything that is posted on their site. It wouldn't be, you know, if they didn't have those protections, they would become more censorious. They would have to ban more things, because they would be worried about being sued or being arrested. So actually, those protections, I mean, you're talking about the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, and that is an important protection. But the wording does give them the loophole to therefore censor with impunity. And that was not the original intention. And that's important. That needs to be understood. So it might just be simply a matter of changing the wording so that they can't simply remove material that they find offensive or objectionable on ideological grounds, but they do retain the right to remove illegal content, or indeed that they will not be held legally accountable for illegal content that appears on their platform. That would be possible. But as I say, there is no appetite among the current administration to do anything about it. It's actually quite an easy fix.
I'll ask you a last question to come back, I think, to the the core point of the book. I mean, I'm an old fellow at this point. I think young people are generally stupid. They have lots of silly opinions and they express them with far too much confidence because they don't know enough. I was the same myself. So I know all about that. I think academics are often a pain in the ass and deliberately opaque and full of ideas that wouldn't stand up to scrutiny in the real world. I have lots of other prejudices like these. And I also think that life has always been thus to some extent. You know, students have always been that way. Academics have always been a bit like that. Is there a possibility that this is just a moment in cultural history? I mean, I'm thinking, I mean, you write for and your podcast is Unspiked. That comes out of a weird little Trotskyite groupuscule in the 1980s, which had all kinds of strange views about how the entirety of society was a capitalist scam and it needed to be ripped apart and there was no point in reforming any of it to make lives better, make them worse so that you could build it all back from scratch. And, you know, and now look where they are now. In some ways, they're quite similar to the kind of woke progressive movement you're describing now. It's almost the same kind of thing to some extent.
No, not really, because you're describing. I mean, this is a very good example, I think, of the overemphasis on political tribalism. You know, the those who dismiss Spiked because it came out of the ashes of the RCP, the Revolutionary Communist Party, back in the day, forget that the RCP, in fact, disbanded when I was still at school. It hasn't been around for over 20 years. It's not relevant anymore. So it's just a means to attack something through this kind of conspiratorial idea.
That's fine. But what I'm saying is, the RCP was the kind of which, you know, mostly existed on college campuses, was in a way the kind of progressive movement, part of the progressive movement of its day, you know?
Well, I think what you're saying is that, you know, you often get these glitches where you get these sort of radical movements that ultimately die off, I suppose, is what you're saying, and that we shouldn't worry too much about them. That's true, except the RCP, of course, and never became the dominant force in the civil service, in higher education, in schools, in politics, in law enforcement, in the media, in the arts. And that is what has happened with critical social justice and intersectionality. It is the dominant force now. And we can pretend it's not all we like, but the evidence is quite clear on this and we're going to have to do something about it. So I like to be optimistic and I'd love to say, oh yeah, I think this is probably just a product of a few young people. But we know that's not the case anymore. I remember about 5 years ago when I used to talk about this stuff, the most common criticism I had was, oh, well, you're just talking about a few students on university campuses being a bit overzealous. And as you say, young people tend to have that idea that they know everything. And of course, they don't. And there's nothing new about this. But I don't get that criticism very often now nowadays, because so evidently the evidence of everything I've been talking about is plain to see for everyone. And the culture war has exploded into the mainstream. And therefore, it isn't something that we can just say is confined to the recesses of student unions and certain dark areas on the internet. It is now mainstream. It is now institutionally powerful. And when you get institutional forms of power that are so regressive and are so illiberal, I think it is a duty to push back against it if you believe in liberalism, which I do. And I think that's why this is a different thing. And it is a bigger worry. And it's not just down to dismissing young people, which is something I absolutely never do. I think this is why I often talk at schools and universities and things. I've often found, to be honest, when it comes to this particular issue, that the most intransigent are people from my own generation. It seems to be that generation who have the clout within universities now, who are particularly intolerant. But, you know, so maybe it will die off. I hope you're right. I hope, you know, I think being optimistic is great, but I think when it comes to the erosion of liberal values, if you ignore the problem, then they do erode. So it actually takes active involvement to preserve the liberties that we all seem to take for granted. The free speech, as we know from looking at history, as I've said, is a miraculous and rare thing. It's not the case that we won that argument and now we've got it in the bag and we can rest on our laurels and it's going to be fine forevermore. I think the signs that we're seeing at the moment, I don't call it a crisis, as you'll know from the book, but I do say we are seeing the first signs of that slipping away and we need to be vigilant. And that's all I'm saying.
Andrew Doyle, thanks very much indeed for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Free Speech and Why It Matters by Andrew Doyle is published by Constable. Thanks to Andrew and to our producer, Suzanne Brennan, and JJ Vernon, our engineer. We will be back on your feed very soon indeed. But until then, remember that you can mail us with your thoughts and questions at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. Until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.